Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. There is a better way to practice architecture. When you build a thriving business, you will then have the time and the financial resources to do your best work, to design the architecture that you want to design. We've built a powerful program of resources, training, and community for you, the small firm architect. We'll show you how to build a better business so you can be a better architect. Entree Architect Academy. To learn more, visit the homepage at entrearchitect.com. You are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, and this is episode 186. Welcome back to the Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and this is the podcast dedicated to a successful life as a small firm architect. Whether you have plans to someday start your own firm, whether you're in the process of launching a startup, or you might be an experienced small firm architect just trying to make a difference, this podcast is for you. My goal is to inspire you to build a better business so that you may pursue your purpose with passion and live the life of your dreams. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by our platform sponsors, FreshBooks, Core by BQE Software, and Arcat. And I'm going to share more about these great companies later in the show. But before we get started here, just take a quick note to schedule some time later today, as soon as you're finished listening here, to go visit each one of them and let them know that you appreciate them for supporting us, the Entree Architect community. Brandon Hubbard, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
It's good having you here. Brandon is a licensed architect based in San Francisco, California, and the founder of thearchitectsguide.com, a website dedicated to helping architects with their job applications and career goals. He practiced architecture with Foster and Partners in London, where he worked on several high-profile design projects, including Heathrow Terminal 3, the Bloomberg headquarters in London, and the Samba, is that pronounced Samba?
Samba Bank Tower.
Samba, yeah. Bank Tower in Riyadh. Currently, he's a senior architect at Heller Manis Architects, back in San Francisco, working on large-scale commercial and residential projects. And you may have seen him online, because he's all over online, where he publishes often about architecture careers at the Architects Guide website, as well as a content provider over at Arc Daily. So you may have seen some of his writing over there. So that, Brandon, that gives us a little bit of a background on you. I want to dive a little bit deeper, like I usually do up here up front. I want to hear your origin story, go back to where you discovered architecture, and share your origin story to where you are today.
Sure, thanks. So I guess I could start way back at the beginning. I was actually born in New Zealand. I lived there until I was around 10 years old. Afterwards, relocated with my family to Montana, where I completed most of my schooling, including a master's in architecture from MSU Bozeman. During my last couple of years at university and shortly after graduation, I was working for a small firm in Bozeman. And it just so happened that the firm landed a $100 million residential project, and it was only a small five-person firm. So in a very short amount of time, I gained a lot of experience trying to coordinate all of that. And afterwards, after graduation, I really enjoyed working on that large-scale project, coordinating all the teams and everything. So looking around Montana, there wasn't a lot of options for that scale of project anymore. So I decided to look abroad and ended up applying for several firms in London and got some offers and ended up joining Foster & Partners in London. And then I was there for 7 years. And during that time, I relocated to Madrid for a while. We did some projects there because there was a client base there. And so, yeah, 7 years of Foster's and huge range of projects there. Rode out the recession in 2008, kind of a scary time for everyone, but survived that. And I was in the UK long enough to gain citizenship there. So I actually have 3D citizenships, the US, the UK, and New Zealand. So got quite a passport collection. And then I moved to San Francisco in 2014 to work with Heller Manis. There's a lot going on here right now, this whole Transbay development, sort of large-scale projects going on. And of course, when I came to California, there's a supplemental exam, so I gave myself a goal of 3 weeks to get that out of the way, finish that. Then I had all this free time afterwards, so I decided to start the Architect's Guide shortly after I came here, and continues to be my fun project in addition to being a full-time architect.
So what pulled you to London? So you started in Montana, you pretty much started your career there and then decided that you wanted a change. But
right.
Why go overseas right off the bat? What was pulling you there?
Well, I had actually wanted to relocate to China before that. But it was this long process where I found out you had to be vaccinated for certain things, which there's a 6-month sort of waiting period. And I was kind of ready to move. I wanted to go now.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, because I'd had an offer in Beijing and then less now, but it was really booming right before the Olympics. And so I had the 6-month period. Well, I had this offer. I was like, well, during the 6-month period, I'll look at other parts, perhaps easier places to move abroad first. So I looked at English-speaking countries, and obviously London's a good example. So I ended up getting some offers there and spent a week in London touring around and thought it happened to be the sunniest London day in the past 10 years. I don't think I ever saw the sun for the next 7 years. I actually got sunburned in the park. So maybe I had a bad impression of London from my visit, but ended up moving there. So it all worked out.
And never made it to China.
I never did. I worked on projects in China, but never actually lived there. Maybe someday.
Did you visit when you were there?
No, I didn't. It was also from London based.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. And then, so what brought you back to the US? Why leave London once you were there?
Yeah, I felt like I reached a point where you sort of have to pick a country, I think, still had family in the US and friends in London. And I felt sort of, I was always flying back and forth. And so even taking the AREs back then, they didn't offer them in London. They do now. But so I was booking tests 3 in a week and flying all the way back and doing that and trying to get them done. So it ended up just being, I felt like I just needed to move back to the US.
It was just time.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And then I wanted the passport to open up all of the EU as an option to work anywhere. But then once Brexit happened, it sort of cut that off. So now I can still go back to the UK, but it's not all of Europe. But
yeah. And then, so when you came back to the US, you landed in San Francisco. Did you intend to land in California or did you sort of look elsewhere and that was your best offer?
I had offers in New York as well. It seemed, based on my sort of background of large scale projects, those were really the two big options, at least a few years ago, of what was happening here in San Francisco. And then, of course, New York's known for large scale projects. So when I was kind of comparing the two, I thought, well, I really wanted a change. I like the outdoors, so I thought New York was pretty much just an American version of London, so I wanted to have an option of a little more outdoors. Since I had grown up in Montana and New Zealand, I felt like California was maybe a bit more my style, and it's worked out. So
yeah. Well, 40 minutes north of New York City is the Catskill Mountains. So,
okay, well,
and the Adirondacks are north of those. So.
Nothing against New York.
So you landed in San Francisco, a city that I love. Let's talk a little bit about your decision to go to London, to go abroad. Were there any lessons that you would want to share? Was it a positive experience? Was it a negative experience? Is it something that you would recommend other architects do?
Well, one of my articles for ArcDaily was something like 7 reasons you shouldn't work abroad in architecture,
and that
a lot of angry comments. So much so I wrote an article responding to all the angry comments.
That means traffic.
Normally I try to ignore them, but and it's definitely good and bad, I think. I think it's hard. I think it's great for, depending on what your goals are, I think. If your goal is to meet a diverse group of people and work on interesting projects, then potentially moving abroad or just outside of your own sort of safety area is a good idea to sort of maybe shake your brain a little bit,
yeah,
get some new ideas going. Definitely seeing Europe, a flight that's an hour long, you'll be in a completely different country. Where in the US, you'll just be in a different state. So I think definitely Europe's a great option for anyone living in the US, and vice versa for anyone wanting to come over to the US from Europe. I think some of the downsides is potentially if you're gaining a lot of experience, if I'm learning all of the regulations and codes and everything in Europe, there is obviously some overlap. But if I come back to the US, there's going to be a bit of a disconnect between the US-based regulations and local codes. Whereas if you're, you know, spend your entire career in one location, you know everyone, you know all of the codes, you know all of the regulations. So I think by being separated from that a little bit can be challenging and sort of have to relearn a lot of things when you come back. But in my experience, it was generally positive. So
yeah, that's interesting. I never thought of it that way. You know, you often hear about architects going abroad to experience the rest of the world, which is, you know, I think very, very positive. I think that sort of gives you a perspective that exists outside of the United States. There are different, yeah, points of view and different ways of doing architecture, and you just experience different things that you wouldn't experience here. But I never actually considered the fact that if you are going to, you know, practice there, that you're learning architecture based on the codes and the regulations of the, you know, jurisdiction that you're working in. And when you come back, you have to relearn a lot of that, or even unlearn some of it when you come back to the United States.
I think also, too, if your intention is to start your own firm, a lot of that comes from networking in that environment, knowing people. Mm-hmm. And if you're if I'm thrown into San Francisco and it's a little bit different, sort of the social media environment. Like we wouldn't have known each other if it wasn't for the internet. But
yeah.
So when you're suddenly exposed to a new environment, you have to then start your network all over again. So I think that can be challenging if your intention is to start your own firm too. But of course, I've had plenty of friends move from London and relocate to the US and they're doing fine. So
yeah. Yeah. You know, it's certainly not a bad thing. There's just positive and negative pieces,
right,
to it.
Yeah.
So you come back to the United States, you base yourself in San Francisco, and you start this new platform called The Architect's Guide online. And it's a place where you help people with their careers and sort of help them find a job in architecture and advance their careers. So what inspired you to do that? I mean, you come back from Foster, you get a new job doing big projects in California. Why build this platform?
I think part of it came from when I was at Foster's, I received so many emails from people, more or less asking how to get a job there. Such an sort of iconic firm, especially with, yeah, all the Apple stuff going on. And then they'd send me the resumes and portfolios and then ask me to get them a job. And I sort of looked at it and said, well, there's a lot of problems with this. So I would try and provide feedback to them, say, look, change this, move this around, reword all of this, you know, fix typos. And then I would do all of that. And then once they'd sort of incorporated my comments, then I would forward it on to the senior management in the firm. And then also when I was at Foster's, I gave a lot of tours of the office to architects and students. And usually after the tour, I would sit down with them to answer any questions. And again, the conversation would go to, how can I get a job here? So I would sometimes spend hours talking to these people about what I did. Because one of the things I did that seemed to always get people's attention was that I applied to Foster's with a 2-page portfolio. And so most of the portfolios are getting were, you know, 60, 80, 100 pages, and mine is only 2. So that's another thing I've hence since written about. But so I also found I was giving the same advice over and over again. So when I came here, I thought this is got to be an easier way than me just emailing one person at a time. So I decided to sort of take this body of knowledge I had accumulated over the past several years and turn that into a website, which then became the Architect's Guide. So it just made it easier for me too, that instead of replying, I could just say, oh, check this article out.
Yeah. Yeah. So you built it out of survival.
I guess so. Yeah. Keep my, and ironically though, my email's gone way up in terms of number per day. So
yeah,
I guess,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, now you built a platform that people are finding you there, and so now you're getting even more questions. But the benefit of the platform is that you have those articles, that you at least you have a very quick way to say, hey, just check this article out, or, you know, you have offerings and services as well on there now. So you can actually, you know, point them in the direction of one of those services. Let's go just quickly back to that 2-page portfolio. Tell me that story. Well, how did you get the job with only a 2-page portfolio?
Well, I usually teach 2 portfolios. So one is your application portfolio and one is your interview portfolio. My interview portfolio, when I got the invite, was much longer and included a bunch of things, but the actual application portfolio was only 2 pages. So one page was academic work and one page was professional work. So I think there was three photos per page, and then short description of what I always talk about is, what have you actually done on it? I think I see a lot of applications that make the mistake of just, first of all, way too much text usually, and not describing what you actually did on the project. It's always just talking about how great the project is and all its features and it's sustainable, but that doesn't really let the employer know your skills and what sort of your role in the project was. So I really worked hard to sort of highlight what I did on all these projects, and it worked out.
So,
and also,
go ahead.
Also, people just don't have a lot of time to read these things. So most firms, generally speaking, don't have an HR department. So there's not someone dedicated to going through every application. It's just an architect taking some time out of his day to go through his applications. And if he has to sort through 60 pages, maybe it's a bit harder to get through. And I think you're often judged on your weakest work. So if you shorten it up, odds are they'll just look at the good stuff.
Yeah. So do you think that in addition to the fact that you focused on the quality rather than the quantity, but the fact that it was different than all of the others, if everybody else is sending 80-page portfolios and yours is, you know, highlighted that it's shorter, do you think that also sort of helps you get noticed?
I think that that's possible. I remember one of my professors said he was going to have a bet with another professor saying that there could be a thesis that was only 2 pages long and that would be sufficient. So I kind of had that in the back of my mind as well. Like if something's really worth saying, maybe you can squeeze it into as little as possible. And also I think another thing is if it's very short, it's almost like a first date. You just tell a little bit about yourself. You don't tell your entire life story. You kind of build up a little bit of interest. It's like, well, I want to learn more about this person, and so I'll invite them for an interview.
Yeah, but it definitely has to be high quality. That if it is going to be short, it has to be clearly well designed, well developed, and give a place where they can find additional information. Right. So it can't be just 2 pages of junk. you know, because it might yeah. pop out and they'll look at it and it'll go right into the trash.
Yeah, ideally, yeah. I think it's also important to know who you're sending it to. Are you sending it to an architect or are you sending it to an HR department? Mm-hmm. So all of the large firms have usually uploads to their websites. So most times it'll go to an HR manager and they'll review it. So that's different than an architect reviewing it. So whether or not that means you need to focus more or less on design and more on filling the criteria of a particular position, it depends, but yeah. I would err more on the filling the bullet points of a particular position if you're applying to a large office.
Yeah. So know your audience, know who you're talking to and how that person is structured within the firm.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, I want to stay on this because I think that, the idea of getting, a job today is very different. When I went to school in the 90s, pretty much it was obviously computers were there. Social media was very, very, very young, wasn't being used at all for getting jobs. Everything that I did was cover letters and resumes, and I didn't get a job. And I came out in the recession in 93. Nobody was being hired. Right. I've written about it. If anybody's interested, they can go to the blog and find out the story of how I got hired. But the one thing that I do credit is that I did make myself look different. That I for a long time, I was sending out the resume just like I was taught how to send out the resume. And then finally, I decided to design a trifold brochure with limited projects. And just, you know, I had my resume on one side, I had the portfolio or my cover letter on the other side. So it was just one sheet of paper, both sides folded in three and sent it out. And that got me noticed. Didn't get me the job, but it got me noticed in a pile of hundreds of email resumes because it was a recession. Everybody was looking for work. And so I definitely say, you know, figure out how to get noticed, right? I mean, how to get noticed. Yep. And then once you get noticed, how do you stand out once you're in the pile of shortlists? Let's take a quick break here to say thank you to our platform sponsors here at Entre Architect, BQE Software, Artcat, and FreshBooks. This podcast episode is sponsored by BQE Software, the makers of BQE Core. BQE Core revolutionizes the way architects manage projects, time and expenses, billing, and accounting. Made by BQE, the company behind ArchiOffice, Core saves you time while giving you the visibility, the flexibility, and the power you need to grow your firm. Work from anywhere, seamlessly collaborate, and gain transformative insights with Core's groundbreaking platform. Learn more and get a free trial at entrearchitect.com/BQE. Hey, and if you want to see a demonstration of Core, I recently invited Stephen Burns of BQE Software to join me for a live Entre Architect special session webinar, where Steve had the opportunity to show us inside Core and all it has to offer us small firm architects. And a recording of that webinar is available to our community, the Entre Architect community, for free at entrearchitect.com/BQE webinar. So go check that out, and when you're ready to give it a try, visit entrearchitect.com/BQE and access your fully functional trial of Core free for 15 days. Hey, if you've been listening to this podcast anytime during the past few months, you've heard me talking about our friends over at Artcat, and hopefully you're already using their free resources on a regular basis. But for those of you who have not yet checked them out, Artcat is a great tool for small firm architects. Artcat has a huge library of free content, CAD, BIM, specifications, and more. And they've done all the work for you. I mean it. They've done all the work. If you need a spec, click on over and download a CSI three-part specification in multiple formats, free. How about CAD details or BIM objects, all free, click of a mouse. Artcat has tons of building product content ready for you to use, and it's all completely free. You don't even have to register to download the content. And they've recently launched something new. It's called Charette. Create a project, assign tasks, share and collaborate with colleagues and clients, all in real time. Pull content directly from the Artcat database or from anywhere out on the web and keep it in Charette. It's another free resource from RCAT for you, the Entree Architect community. Visit them right now. Go check them out. EntreeArchitect.com/RCAT. That's A-R-C-A-T. EntreeArchitect.com/RCAT. And click on the Charette icon right there on the homepage to check out Charette. Imagine what you can do if you had an additional 2 days every month to dedicate to anything that you want. Maybe you just want to spend more time on design. Maybe you want to start building that new business process. Maybe you want to start painting again. Maybe you want to spend more time with your kids. Or maybe you want to finally start that development project. Well, when you're a small firm architect using FreshBooks cloud accounting software, you could save 192 hours every month. That's 2 business days every month. That's the amount of administrative time that you could save this year if you're using FreshBooks. FreshBooks makes it simple to send invoices, post your expenses, automatically track your time for the whole team by project, and get organized with reports, communication, and notifications. My favorite feature of FreshBooks is the automated email reminders sent to my clients to remind them to pay their bills. That's done automatically, and you control the whole thing. Sign up for a free 30-day unrestricted trial and get ready for the simplest way to be more productive, organized, and most importantly, get paid faster. Visit EntreeArchitect.com/FreshBooks to access FreshBooks for free. And be sure to enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section. BQE Software, RCAT, and FreshBooks. Please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community.
It was going around for a while. There was an applicant to Big Brick Engels' office, yep, where he did a YouTube video almost poking fun at the office a little bit. And it was I wouldn't recommend doing that. It was pretty entertaining. I'm sure you can just Google it, but he ended up getting an offer. So it's interesting. So yeah, any way you can stand out, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, but you want to get noticed in a positive way. If you get noticed in a negative way, it's not going to work so well.
I mean, that's kind of the scary thing of social media, is that one misinterpretation of something you've said. And also, I see a lot of architecture students, they have this massive social media presence. Mm-hmm. They've been on it, say, since they were in high school. So that could be, you know, a better part of a decade of almost everything you've eaten for the past day may not be the best thing for a potential employer to be able to search through at any moment. And that's best case scenario. So I'd say just keep in mind of what your footprint is, and just at least Google yourself and see what comes up.
Yeah, it's a very different world than it was when I went to school and was looking for that job. Let's talk about that a little bit more. But let's focus, rather than students, because I think students are hearing that, they're learning that, they're coming out of school, understanding how social media works. How their websites should look and their resumes should look. But what about, you know, architects that have been in the profession that haven't been through this process? Maybe they were working for somebody and they want to make a move. They want to move to another firm, maybe to Advance or to a different place. And they need to make that transition through this process of resumes and portfolios. What would you recommend to those people who haven't been educated through this process? What are some of the most important pieces that they need to make sure that they get right?
Well, I think it kind of comes down to, what do you want? So I get a lot of questions from people who have more experience, but they often want to do something different than what they've been doing, which is kind of natural. So if they work for a small firm, they want to move to a large firm and vice versa. So I think it's seeing where you want to go and taking your sort of basket of experience and looking at what you can pull from that existing experience and how you can apply it to this new future position. So if you've been working for a small firm doing, you know, residential housing and other small commercial property, but you want to work on airports or something, you can't say, I did this house and now I want to work on this airport. That doesn't translate directly. But what you could say is, I've been managing this project, working directly with the client, coordinating the consultants, and all of that stuff translates much easier. So I found it's, you try and put yourself in the role of the hiring manager and seeing, what am I looking for and what am I looking to fill? It may not be the exact project experience, but it's a good chance that you can find some relationships between the two.
So skills, really, you know, if you're thinking about hopping from, you know, a small firm to a large firm or a commercial firm to a residential firm, like you said, that your past experience may not translate so well. But if you talk about the skills that you have from doing residential work, from maybe doing multifamily or larger scale or managing all these projects at the same time, and you talk about those as your strengths, rather than saying, I've done, you know, 14 houses, let's do the hospital. The skills may translate better. It may get you noticed and maybe get you into the door where you can explain yourself in person.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So know yourself, right? I mean, that's, so if the first lesson is know your audience, we talked about before, know who you're talking to. Maybe the second lesson is know yourself, know who you are, what your strengths are, and talk about those strengths.
Yeah. I see that a lot as well, that if it's often talked about, what's your elevator pitch? So tell me, you know, what are you good at? And a lot of people have trouble answering that. And it is kind of a hard question because you almost don't want to limit yourself to just a couple of sentences, especially in architecture, because there's so many different areas of speciality and expertise. It's, are you a BIM manager? Are you a designer? Are you a drafter? It's sort of, you know, what are you really proud of and what do you really excel at? That if you came into an office, you're saying, this is what I'm bringing and this is how I'm contributing to the firm.
Yeah. And it may not be, you know, the design position, you know, or it may not be the spec writer. If you know yourself well, and you've intentionally gone out to explore who you are, you know, the taking some of these personality tests like Strengths Finders and some of these other personality tests. So you really have it in your head. You really understand who you are and where you come from and what your strengths are. That will allow you to document that on your resume, in your portfolio, on your online footprint. When you go into for the interview, you'll be able to speak well about who you are and what your strengths are and what you're not so good at. Because I think that would also show a potential employer, you know, that this is somebody who's different. They're very self-aware of who they are. They will fit right there because they know who they are. They know what their strengths are as well as what their weaknesses are.
Yeah, I always hear that saying, you should focus on your weak areas. I say focus on your strengths.
Yeah, I agree.
You can work on the weak areas, but really double down on your strengths because that's where you're going to move ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're your strengths for a reason, right?
Right.
If you have weaknesses, it's because of who you are and where you're from. You're going to get much farther trying to grow your strengths rather than trying to fix your weaknesses.
Right. Exactly.
So what are some, you know, if we get the, you know, get to know your audience well and we get to know ourselves well and somebody wants to make that leap, and maybe it's even somebody who's a sole practitioner, a lot of our audience, sole practitioners or people in very small firms, and they're just tired of this, you know, and they want to go work for somebody else.
Yep.
Where would you talk to somebody like that? If somebody came to you and emailed you and said, I'm just tired of, you know, running my own firm and struggling here, I want to move to another place. What would you say to that person?
I've actually had that question this week. I'm actually, because I work with, I have coaching clients, so I help them develop their applications. And I was actually surprised. A lot of them, some of them have 20 plus years of experience. I had originally sort of pictured my target market of, you know, fresh out of school, but
yeah, I'm not surprised.
A particular client actually is looking to transition from a sole practitioner back into a firm. So it's been interesting to take 20 plus years of experience and sort of condense it down into here's a concise application for a potential employer. So I think, and maybe I'm wrong on this, that employers are a little intimidated by a sole practitioner, that they, especially if they've been doing it for 20 years, they may think this person is going to come in and just try and take over and not be a team player and just try and run the show, whereas I run the show. So I think there's a little bit of a stigma with that. And I think that can be challenging to get over that and say, I'm just, and that's why I think you have to be clear in your documentation. Particularly, I think your cover letter is very important for this, saying why you're making this transition. Because that's the first thing an employer is going to see is, well, you've had your own office for 20 years. Why? So I think you have to be very clear about why you're making the move and be honest. Maybe not too honest, but do your best to.
Yeah, but you have to answer that question.
Yeah, because that's obviously the question on their mind, why you're looking to transition. So I think, you have to be very precise about how you answer that unsaid question in your application. So I think that's where I'm a big fan of the cover letter. It seems to be maybe going away a little bit, but I think it's very important. It adds a personal touch where resume is sort of cold, and the letter really helps to explain your situation and give an overview.
How important do you think building relationships with potential employers is? I mean, today with social media, with Twitter and Facebook, you can actually reach out to these people and connect with somebody in that firm and build a relationship with them online. How important do you think that is in making that move sort of strategically?
I think it's really important. I think most of the work I've gotten, even Heller Manis was, we were doing a joint venture with Foster's. So I kind of came in through that way, which is also another reminder, don't burn any bridges as you're working your way through your career. Architecture's a relatively small community. So the odds are someone, your future boss knows your previous boss, there's a good chance of that. So I think that's one thing to keep in mind. And certainly with social media, I think you have to be careful about how you do it. Don't bombard some firm with questions and retweets and emails. But I think there's a way of doing it. Say, wow, I really like this project. I enjoyed that. If they're mentioned in the news, something like that, it's a good way to just sort of let them know you're out there. It's definitely challenging.
I think it's just like marketing your firm. You don't want to be out there just saying, hey, we're great, we're great, we're great, we're great. You know, you want to build a relationship. You want to reach out to the people that you might be interested in and just connect with them. Just comment on something they posted and build a relationship. Like you may have, met them in a bar and you just want to have a conversation with them. And you're just trying to learn a little bit about who they are and what they're doing. And over time, you'll build a relationship and a connection. And then maybe that person becomes a trusted advisor to you because now you have this relationship, which online relationships are real relationships. They're people who really care about each other that they've never met.
Right.
It can go a long way.
Yeah, definitely. I think if you can, I guess not necessarily have an agenda when you reach out to people. It's just sort of, well, I'm just making a connection, because a lot of relationships I've made online are just sort of, I would have never predicted down the line how things would have worked out. So having this network can really open doors that you didn't even know existed. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah. I think also social media and the internet allow us to be much more targeted as well. And I'm not sure how students coming out of architecture school now are doing it, but when I was looking for a job, it was, a shotgun. You send out 100 resumes to everybody that you can possibly send it out, and maybe you'll get two or three interviews. Today, you can target. You can say and learn a lot about a specific firm, and then build a resume and a portfolio that is customized to that firm to fill a position that you know that they may have or may be looking for. Talk about that a little bit, how that's possible today.
Yeah, well, I get a lot of emails saying, I've sent out 200 resumes and I haven't heard back yet. Yeah. And that's usually a red flag, meaning that they've done exactly that. They've just created some generic application and just shotgunned it to every firm on the East Coast. Whereas I'm always talking about creating, because now we have so much information on any firm, every project they've ever done, everyone that works there. You're able to look at their body of work and target your experience and skills to that particular firm, which I think is really powerful. You sort of get to spy on them a little bit and do your homework. And so I think if you're conscious about the firm you're looking to move to and build a really targeted application, you're much more likely to succeed.
Yeah, and find the name of the person that you're sending it to. I get
exactly.
probably 6 or 7 resumes a week with yeah. to whom it may concern or hi. You know,
right.
A casual letter to a friend. This is a professional document that
right.
that you're pitching to somebody. And if I get something that says to whom it may concern, it doesn't go past that. It gets deleted. I don't care how good it is. Today with the internet, especially me, you type anything about Entre Architect or Entrepreneur Architect or my name, you can find out my name and how to spell it. So right. if my name is not on the document in the email, it gets deleted.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So are there any other tips that you could provide to somebody who might be out there looking?
I think it would be to really have this thing where the Pareto principle, and if you've heard of that, it's where for most events, roughly 80% of the effects come from 20% of the causes. So I think you should really focus on that that 20%. So what gets the most results? So don't focus on, I get some criticism on this, but don't turn your name into a logo. Don't spend time doing that, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing wrong with it, but really focus on what's going to get the best results. It's creating a targeted application. It's building a concise portfolio. It's networking. It's all the things we've talked about where it's really spend your time doing on the working on things that matter. You can set up, I go back and forth on online portfolios. I think they have their place, but they're not my favorite thing right now just because a lot of them are free and there's pop-ups and it's a little less, it distracts, I think, away from what you should be focusing on. So I would say, yeah, really know what you want and just go after that and don't get too distracted by everything else around you.
How do you feel about people sort of building a brand around themselves? Because you mentioned the logo, and I'm not saying the logo is the brand. I'm saying the story right. of who you are and the strengths that come with you and the things that people know you about, the story that's told about you. That intentional story is your brand.
Right.
How important is that? And maybe it's not important, but what are your thoughts on that?
I think that's what you have to do now. I think, author Seth Godin talks about that in his book, Lynchpin, where you become this outstanding, indispensable member, whether you're talking about the architecture community or within that office, you're going to be the last person that gets fired because you're so essential to how that firm works based on either your skills or you're just a great person to be around, all of these things combined. So I think building your brand offline and online can really help with that. So,
yeah, that's a great book. Lynchpin by Seth Godin, just in case anybody missed it. But great book. I would recommend every book that Seth Godin has ever written. But specifically in this context, Lynchpin is a fantastic book about exactly what Brandon's saying, is that you make yourself indispensable and then they won't want to fire you because they can't fire you.
Right.
And building a brand around who you are and what you do and the strengths you are of what you have. It's really great. So let's talk about the Architect's Guide itself and what you're offering there. So talk about that a little bit. You do a blog. You have a bunch of offerings there. You have some coaching services. What can people expect when they go there?
Yeah, so I have a job resources page. I have tons of articles there you can kind of go through. It's on the full range of topics, so resumes, portfolios, cover letters, interviews, negotiations. So I really looked at from start to end sort of how to get what you want in an architecture position. I have resources there. So I have my coaching package where I work directly with people one-on-one, sort of give me what you have. I take a look at it and then I start building your applications and helping provide sort of a third party feedback and helping you out along the way of the application process. So really sort of helping people out that way. And then I also have packages of guides. So I have guides on applications, interviews, and resumes. And then also I've started a new thing where I was getting so many emails from offices asking me if they could find people for this position, and I never really knew what to do with this information. So now I have a service where I take all of those offers and put them in an email every week for people. So people have enjoyed that lately. So that's kind of been my latest thing.
Yeah. What a great platform that you've built there. You know, it's the only one that I know of that's doing it for architects. I thank you for doing that. I appreciate you for putting the time and effort into building such a great platform for the profession. It's at thearchitectsguide.com. I want to ask you one question before we wrap up here. What's one thing that a small firm architect could do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
I think sort of what I touched on earlier is to really focus on what gets the best return on your investment of time and money. I think we have a tendency to value our time at zero, and I think that's a huge mistake. I think if you think about whether I should spend 3 hours looking to save $15 on this particular service or something, you valued your time at $5 an hour. So that's some one thing I've been trying to work on, is really be conscious about how I'm spending my time, being careful how to schedule it, and really treating it as a valuable resource.
That's a great one. And I could tell you, the older that you get, the more focused you get on that.
Right.
Because I'm constantly, you know, listening to a podcast or even listening to a song or doing something, and it pop into my head and is like, I'm not going to waste my time on this. My time is way too valuable to listen to the rest of this that I'm not interested in. So I think that's great advice. So your website is thearchitectsguide.com. You're on Facebook and Twitter at Architects Guide without the. So it's at Architects Guide. LinkedIn, very active on LinkedIn. Brandon Hubbard, just search him up there. And all of these will be on the show notes at entrearchitect.com/episode186. We'll have links to all of this and everything that we talked about in the show. Brandon, thank you very much for coming by here and sharing your knowledge and letting people know what you're doing over there at thearchitectsguide.com.
Thanks, Mark. It was great.
If you liked what we shared here today and find any value in what we're doing here at Entree Architect, and I hope that you are, I ask you to share this episode with a friend. Pick one friend right now that you think might benefit from this episode and share it with them. Complete show notes and a direct link to download this episode will be found right there at entrearchitect.com/episode186. That's the link to share, entrearchitect.com/episode186. Hey, and don't forget to visit the website right there on the homepage and learn more about Entree Architect Academy. It's our private online membership program that's built for you, the small firm entrepreneur architect. That's you. You can build a better business, and we can show you how. To learn more, visit the homepage right there on the homepage, entrearchitect.com. My name is Mark R. LePage, and I am an entrepreneur architect, and I encourage you to go build a better business so you can be a better architect. Love, learn, and share what you know. Thanks for listening, and have a great week.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
typically Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glenn Gehry. Visit glengehry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.